loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we dive back into the fallout from the conclusion of the Mueller probe with Max Blumenthal. Next, the British Parliament has taken over Brexit. What does that mean for Britons? Then there was another attack on the electrical grid in Venezuela as the U.S. pushes for regime change. And finally, we'll go over the results of the Ecuadorian elections and how Julian Assange is under increasing pressure to leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Authorities in Chicago have dropped all charges against actor Jussie Smollett. Smollett was accused of staging a hate crime to secure a higher salary for his work on the hit TV show Empire. But prosecutors have now admitted that there was insufficient evidence to charge him in the first place. Smollett said in a statement today, quote, "I would like nothing more than to just get back to work and move on with my life. But make no mistake, I will always continue to fight for the justice, equality, and betterment of marginalized people everywhere," unquote. Ahmed Gaid Salah, the head of the Algerian army, has called for the end of President Abdelaziz Bouteflika's presidency. Salah said that Bouteflika should be declared unfit for office. Mass protests have broken out in recent weeks in Algeria against the prospect of another term in office for Bouteflika and in favor of deep political reforms. 13 civilians, including 10 children, were killed in a U.S. airstrike today in Afghanistan. It took place during an intense battle with Taliban fighters in the province of Kunduz. Information about the airstrike was made public by the United Nations. Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, announced today that he would make a decision in April about whether or not to challenge Donald Trump in the 2020 Republican primary. Weld said, quote, "I'm leaning toward doing it unless something changes," unquote. Weld is considered to be a centrist Republican. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the fallout from the Mueller probe report. Proponents of the Russiagate conspiracy are scrambling to salvage their reputations in the wake of the conclusion of Robert Mueller's probe that found no evidence of collusion during the 2016 election campaign between the Trump campaign and Russia. Meanwhile, attorney and frequent Trump critic Michael Avenatti was arrested yesterday and charged with multiple felonies related to an alleged attempt to extort at least $20 million from the Nike Corporation. We are joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. Max is a best-selling author and journalist. His latest film is Killing Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Max Blumenthal, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Okay, so you're out of the country. You come back to the United States. And suddenly, after 2 years of breathless reporting by almost all the media about the Trump-Russian connection, the conspiracy, the whole thing collapses. I mean, did you feel like you went from one era to another? And what does the new era look like?
Yeah, I don't know if we're in a new era, but I can tell you that at some point in 2017 or whenever Mueller was impaneled, I remember having a thought that this was going to come crashing down, and it was going to come crashing down really hard on the Democrats and was going to seriously embolden Trump. And I thought all along, and I said this from the beginning, that this was always helping Trump because it was sidelining the real issues that would actually damage Trump that are salient with regular, ordinary American voters. And I remember arguing with Representative Jamie Raskin, who's one of the more progressive members of Congress, who represents one of the most progressive districts in the country around Tacoma Park, Maryland, at this crazy anti-Russian rally that was planned by all of the kind of, you know, Democratic, you know, Democrat groups in Washington, like Move On and all of these other groups, Invincible, I don't even remember what they were called. And they had brought, you know, thousands of mostly older people who are MAGA watchers onto the mall to have this giant anti-Russian rally calling for Trump to be indicted. And Jamie Raskin was there and he gave this outlandish speech calling for regime change in Venezuela and Philippines and Syria and everywhere where Putin was maintaining his axis of evil. And I said, I confronted him after the speech on camera. You can watch the interview on The Real News. And I said, you know, what are you doing, Jamie? You're supposed to be like a progressive member of Congress. You're a constitutional law expert. and you're calling for regime change around the world and hyping up this crazy Russia investigation when you could be talking about Trump's racism, his war on immigrants, you could be talking about his planned $1 trillion tax cut, you could be talking about real issues. And he just seemed completely blindsided because here was a freshman member of Congress trying to make his bones and taking instructions from senior Democrats. He was obviously very ambitious and he was following the script. And now you see that the script that the Democrats, the younger, more progressive Democrats were given by the DNC and progressive leadership has handed Trump his biggest victory yet and possibly reelected him, at least increased his chances. And I knew this day was coming. And so here we are at this day, Democrats and in the media, the corporate media that played into this ridiculous sham. They have nothing to say for themselves. Nothing they say adds up. And, you know, Donald Trump Jr. just having a field day on Twitter. This is, those of us who were skeptics of Russiagate from the left, this is what we saw coming. And, you know, it's amazing to see it materialize.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, too. First of all, I agree with that 100%. I think that the Democrats whipped themselves up into a frenzy with the help of the mainstream media. And despite the fact that there was no real evidence indicating that there was any collusion, they convinced themselves that there was collusion. And then it all came crashing down. So what happens now? I mean, just 2 months ago, everybody in the Democratic Party was congratulating one another with the way Nancy Pelosi had manhandled Donald Trump and she had made him look silly. And now we're talking about the fact that the Democrats may just have reelected Donald Trump. Now what?
Great question. I mean, this was Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's agenda was to follow Mueller. And this was also, you know, we always talk about Donald Trump getting pushed into shutting down the government to have his little wall because Ann Coulter and Sean Hannity and a bunch of demagogic cable news hosts pressured him into it. Well, the Democrats also experienced the same dynamic with Rachel Maddow and all and, you know, 100 other pundits who were cashing in and getting ratings by basically duping an army of rubes into believing that one day Mueller was going to come down with indictments and Trump was going to go. I mean, this was in, you know, the progressive media world that I was in was playing this game as well. And everybody believed that sooner or later Trump was going to go down. And if it wasn't for Russiagate, it was going to be for Stormy Daniels. And now they're just going to have to pay the price that they're going to have to talk about real issues that they spent 2 years not discussing. I saw, you know, Elizabeth Warren meekly to call for releasing the entire memo, releasing the entire Mueller report. And then she quickly pivoted to talking her talks with real Americans, ordinary people who had no interest in Russiagate. Well, if the Democrats had been out there before the campaign talking to normal people, they would have known that nobody cared about Russiagate. It was like a completely elite issue. But now that they're on the campaign trail, they're scrambling to catch up with their own constituency. And by the way, I'm totally for releasing the entire Mueller report. And you know what I think the entire Mueller report will reveal? This is just, you know, speculation. A lot of Jared Kushner and the Trump inner circle's dealings with Israel, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia, and very little to do with Russia.
Max Blumenthal is our guest. The reporting from the Washington Post and MSNBC and CNN is really remarkable because they're all spinning their own catastrophe. I mean, this was a conspiracy theory. This is a conspiracy theory. Let's just call it what it is.
Well, no. It's a hoax. Because, Brian, you know, you and I get called conspiracy theorists for being right. There's conspiracy theories and there's conspiracy facts. But this is just a hoax. That's what it is.
Okay. I will accept the criticism. I will make a self-criticism. Max Blumenthal, listen to this. This is amazing from these people who have been reporting on this hoax for the past 2 years, spinning now that their entire hoax has collapsed. Here's a headline from the Washington Post. Report lets 2020 hopefuls focus on kitchen table issues. I just want to read these sentences because it's so, it's amazing. Anyway, the race for the White House shifted into new territory Monday in the wake of the release of a summary of the special counsel's report pitting the emboldened President Trump against Democratic contenders eager to shine the political spotlight on kitchen table issues such as health care and jobs. Quote, as Trump declared himself vindicated by Robert S. Mueller III's findings that he did not conspire with Russia in the 2016 elections, Democrats saw an opening to focus anew on matters that many of them have argued are more critical to winning back swing voters than the findings of any new investigation. There's a shocking piece of information.
It's all politics.
And the Democrats couldn't talk about these issues earlier because Russiagate was imposed on them and it hung over them and they just had to focus almost 24/7 on it. It's an incredible doublespeak here.
It's incredible. And I really think that the Democratic Party leadership didn't want to talk about those issues. When they say kitchen table issues, that's, you know, American mainstream media code for class issues, for economic issues. In a country which is experiencing record inequality, that doesn't have a functional economy anymore, where people can work union jobs and expect to retire and have a pension. So I said this actually on Tucker Carlson's show back in 2017, because it was, you know, the only national show that would agree to let me make a left critique of Russiagate. I said that the Democrats love Russiagate because it allows them to oppose Trump without having to do anything progressive, referring to the Democratic leadership of Pelosi and Schumer, who are, you know, extremely wealthy people who represent Wall Street's interests. And I always thought that these elite Democrats didn't actually want to talk about corporations, so Russiagate fit their needs. They share a lot of interests, actually, with Trump. Now they do. And, you know, so in some sense, this can help an Elizabeth Warren. This can help a Bernie Sanders who didn't want to have to deal with some foreign intrigue and want to talk about class issues. But it's been 2 years and they don't have a narrative going into the campaign. And that is largely to do with this gigantic sham. And I want to make another point, which is that while this is being understood as a giant failure and a loss of the media, correctly so, basically, MSNBC, CNN, The Washington Post, and The New York Times are the fire festival of journalism. But the fact is that a lot of goals were accomplished here, and they were accomplished by the intelligence services, which participated heavily in manufacturing the narrative of Russiagate in order to generate consent for a new Cold War. And these elements, including former intelligence officials, Michael Hayden, John Brennan, James Clapper, Philip Mudd, these characters who are now contributors in the Media Fire Festival, they won. They got what they wanted because our relationship with the only other nuclear-armed superpower in the world has been completely destroyed, and there is no hope for a reset. The record defense budgets are going to come as they expected, and we've pivoted from the war on terror to the great power conflict that these hawks in the intelligence services always benefit from.
John, I think Max is right. That is the big story. There could be the story that these guys failed, that this was a catastrophic failure. That's true. But they have pivoted so quickly already. You might think that they would do this big self-criticism. Hey, we misled you for 2 years about how the walls were closing in on Donald Trump, that the collusion was a fact. Certainly, it was a religious article of faith.
And those were the words they were using.
Yeah. And we played that tape, you know, that Jimmy Dore had played. The walls are closing in like 18,000 times where they said this is the beginning of the end of Trump. They could have done that self-criticism. But as Max is pointing out, they've pivoted very quickly to the real narrative of the intelligence agencies. The editorial today in today's Washington Post is titled, "A Timely Reminder from Mr. Mueller." Now, you would think, well, the Washington Post was vindicated. But of course, the Mueller report says there was no collusion. But it's this underlying issue. Russia attacked our election in 2016, and we are not prepared for another assault. And then it goes on and on about how the Mueller report has confirmed Russia did it. They attacked the 2016 election. They're going to do it again. We're not prepared. And then they call for additional sanctions. They call on Donald Trump now, who yesterday they were saying was the traitor, the stooge of the Kremlin. They're now saying add additional sanctions on the Kremlin because the Mueller report has confirmed this fundamental truth. And Max, you're right. That's where this is going. This is not going to stop.
No, and that's kind of, this is the parachute for the media that lied and deployed a WMD-level deception, obviously without the million Iraqi deaths attached to it, against the American public, to manufacture consent, as I said, for a new Cold War. The parachute is, well, Russia attacked our 2016 elections and they'll do it again. I was just reading this crazy article in Vox, which is supposed to be an explainer site, that says that, I think this is almost a direct quote, all Russia needs to continue its campaign against America is for America to continue to hold elections. So we're never going to hear the end of it. And we're going to hear about endless Russian attacks on our democracy because the narrative is baked in and you have a whole sector of the American public, which happens to be a more educated sector of the American public that bought into this, ironically, that wants to believe in it and that has been cultivated with Russophobic attitudes and knows very little, next to nothing, about Russia, Russia's role in the world, or U.S. relations with Russia, or why it might be a good idea for the U.S. to have peaceful relations with Russia. We're going to see candidates who challenge that view, like Tulsi Gabbard, continue to be smeared without any recourse. And we will see Russiagate deployed against Bernie Sanders because another fallback here is the internet research agency Troll Farm interfered in our election and Mueller indicted them. And how about that? And of course, when that indictment came out, there were a series of stories in CNN and MSNBC about how they had helped Bernie by, for example, putting up a page with a buff Bernie LGBTQ-themed coloring book hyping up Bernie Sanders. And so Bernie will be accused of being, if not a useful idiot, someone who is inadvertently helped by the Russian troll farm. As I said from the beginning, this will ultimately blow back on the left and on against anyone who challenges permanent war. And so I think this narrative is too convenient for the national security state, which has used the media so effectively as its marionette and megaphone, for it to just go away today. On the other hand, for Trump, it's the ultimate gift horse going into a re-election. And I think he's the favorite. He's the favorite here.
I have to agree.
Yeah.
I have to agree. He's the favorite. We've seen this role reversal over the last 2 years too. Brian, we've talked about this on the show a million times of the Democrats now being the anti-Russian zealots and the Republicans being the moderates on this issue. The Democrats put everything they had on the line here on this collusion thing, and it fell apart. And now they're just scrambling to try to save themselves.
Yeah, and as Max is pointing out, they're just changing the subject. The subject isn't that Trump is Trump is the president because of Russia. They're changing that subject. They're saying the big story is that Russia attacked. Yes, their preferred candidate, Donald Trump, actually lost the vote by 3.2 million votes. They could attack the Electoral College, because that's the only reason Trump is president. But they didn't do that. They focused on Russia, and they've done it over and over again. Now, here's another part of the story. Max Blumenthal, our guest, Ben Norton, Glenn Greenwald, Matt Taibbi, Aaron Maté, and I don't mean to leave anybody out, but there's a small handful of people who are challenging the factual basis and the political basis of the Russiagate theory.
And they've been consistent from the very beginning.
And our show, and we've been doing this almost probably more than anyone because we do it every day.
You do it every day, and we listen to your show every day, and it really helped us stay sane, but also to make our own understanding more coherent. So you should really pat yourselves on the back. I really mean it.
Well, that's meaningful, Max, coming from you, and we appreciate it. But having said all that, I'm looking now at the Washington Post again. You, Max Blumenthal, and the other reporters that we just mentioned are actually a bunch of bullies. They didn't name you, but they named Matt Taibbi. The headline is "Serious Journalists Should Be Proud of, Not Bullied Over Their Russian Reporting." This is from Margaret Sullivan in today's Washington Post. And yeah, Matt Taibbi, here's some of the words that she writes. In fact, Mueller came to no such conclusion on obstruction of justice, and on the contrary, stated clearly that his investigation did not exonerate him being Trump. Okay, this is obstruction of justice of what underlying crime if there was no collusion or conspiracy? Then she goes on, perhaps cowed by the criticism which came from the left as well as the right, most notably from author Matt Taibbi, some news organizations may back down from aggressive coverage of Trump. That would be a serious mistake with some regrettable and damaging exceptions. Individual stories that seemingly went too far, reality-based newsletters have done quite well on this story. And it's far from over, so this is no time to retreat. What would be a good idea, though, is to be less obsessed with this subject to the exclusion of others that are far closer to home for most Americans, healthcare, the economy, affordable housing, and crime. So Max Blumenthal, you, Glenn Greenwald, Matt Taibbi, you brutes, you're brutalizing and bullying the media by aggressively reporting the untruth of the media coverage on Russia. It's an amazing spin.
Yeah, I mean, these characters are really vicious. I've known them for and dealt with them for a long time, you know, and they've been vicious about their critics. And there's nothing they hate more than critics from the left, because they can't simply dismiss them as a bunch of Neanderthals. And we know them. We, in many cases, personally know them. But we differ from them in a lot of ways. Those of us who criticized Russiagate from the left, you know, we approach American foreign policy and America itself with a critical eye. We don't see it as an exceptional democracy. We're not liberals. We're actually leftists. Some people would say, oh, you're progressives, but that kind of obfuscates what it's about. We see the U.S. as an empire, and we see its intelligence services and corporate media as a malign force that exists to manufacture consent and to drag us into wars that contravene the interests of working people, whether in the U.S. or in the target countries. And so Russiagate was naturally going to stoke our skepticism. And beyond that, we were confronted with attempts at social media censorship, and it's censoring alternative media, and it's censoring also Sputnik and RT, which, you know, are platforms for a lot of alternative voices. And so we saw the cynicism behind all of this and the kind of authoritarian opportunism. And so we got it right. It wasn't hard to get it right. It was pretty obvious if you weren't a partisan Democrat American exceptionalist, as Margaret Sullivan is. And so one of the things we did was we kind of ripped the cover off of this media that prides itself on being objective and on being the gatekeepers of the truth, and showed that they were simply propagandists for empire. They're really embarrassed, and they're going to strike back in various ways. And so I actually expect the smears on me personally and the smears on people like us to actually increase, especially as we head into the frenetic energy of a campaign cycle. The mainstream beltway press and the corporate media are just going to circle the wagons and try to make us forget this happened. And, you know, we can just go back to the end of the Iraq debacle to remember how the neoconservatives managed to kind of get themselves back into, you know, respectable public life, and how the New York Times and the Washington Post just polished their reputations and everyone forgot it happened. And then we did Libya, and then we did Syria, and then we did Russiagate. And, you know, there's no stopping these people. So the target remains on the backs of people like us. And I don't think we're going to have this brief little period of vindication. You know, I got a little mention in Axios and Vanity Fair, but I'm not expecting to have some no collusion party on the left.
No, indeed. It will have a predictable impact, as Max Blumenthal is telling us. Yeah, I can remember vividly, as one of the leaders of the anti-war movement, a mass movement around the Iraq war, that in 2004, right before the 2004 elections, there was a split within the anti-war movement. Our coalition was the Answer Coalition. There was another coalition. I will go unnamed because I'm going to criticize it. But there was a huge demonstration at the Republican convention in New York in 2004. And the decision was taken by this more liberal wing of the coalition to not make it about the Iraq war, to make the demonstration be about Bush. So focusing on Bush instead of the war was their way of supporting John Kerry, but without saying so. So here you had George W. Bush, who everybody hated in the United States at the time of his election in 2000. He lost the election. The counter-inaugural was 100,000 people. The people coming to his inauguration was one-fifth that. The war was a disaster by 2004. It was clear that the resistance was growing. But by focusing on the awfulness of Bush rather than the social and political content of the war or jobs or the things that actually matter to voters, a tremendous opportunity was lost, and Bush finally won the popular vote. I think we're going to see the same thing right now. People all around the country will now believe that everything that Trump says about his critics in the media is in fact true, because everything he has said about his critics regarding Russiagate has now turned out to be true. And then I'm looking again at here, Max, another editorial today, an op-ed from Dana Milbank here in the Washington Post. Again, not dealing with the real issues and the real failures. The headline is, William Barr has made this a win for Moscow. Barr's summary squandered Mueller's heroic efforts to investigate election interference. So Mueller came up with the wrong sort of culminating view that there was no collusion. His efforts were still heroic, but it was really just Trump's attorney general that squandered this victory. Amazing.
Yeah, that's another sort of part of the fallback narrative for the, you know, losers of the media who wanted to be announcing that they had just completed their worse than Watergate investigation and they were confirmed at every level. And so they're blaming William Barr as sort of a partisan Republican who's in, you know, the Trump crime family for covering this all up. And the question is this, and this is a question that they can't answer. Why would Robert Mueller, who broke his longstanding silence over a false and still unretracted BuzzFeed story, to deny that that story was true, why would he stay silent if William Barr and the Trump crime family came along and misrepresented and distorted all of his hard work and the conclusions of his investigation? The answer is that he would not.
Absolutely. Max, we're running out of time, which is so sad, but we have 3 minutes left. Lawyer Michael Avenatti, high-profile attorney, critic of President Trump, arrested in New York on Monday and charged in what prosecutors call a brazen bid to extort millions of dollars from Nike by threatening to damage the company's image. Simultaneously, federal prosecutors in L.A. filed separate charges accusing Avenatti of wire fraud and bank fraud, allegations that he took a client's settlement money and used it to cover costs related to Avenatti's coffee shop business and other personal expenses. This guy was also built up by CNN and MSNBC and was staging protest demonstration here at Lafayette Park. What was your reaction to the arrest?
Well, this is another gift to the Republicans. I mean, Michael Avenatti was on MSNBC constantly identified with Stormy Daniels, which was another sort of sham foisted on the Democrats to give its, you know, anguished base, the belief that Trump was going to be taken down for hush money to a porn star. Avenatti turned out to be another huckster who will be used by the Trump campaign in 2020 and ahead of 2020 to be identified with the Democrats. He's basically a con artist who is caught now in a shakedown scheme seeking to blackmail Nike. He's also been involved in handling the R. Kelly sex tapes, there's now stories that he may help get R. Kelly off. He's someone who helped the Republicans when Brett Kavanaugh was in deep trouble by making false claims about another woman that Brett Kavanaugh had allegedly sexually assaulted. This turned out to not be true. Everything Michael Avenatti touches is toxic. And he is now someone who is in Donald Trump Jr.'s Twitter feed and will be a big part of the Republican narrative in 2020 to dismiss everything the media has said about Donald Trump. The Republicans and the conservative movement rely on mobilizing resentment on cultural issues. And so Michael Avenatti is the perfect figure to tie all of the kind of culture war issues that the Republicans resent together. And it's amazing that this came the day after Russiagate fell apart with Mueller's conclusion. I mean, it's just such an amazing collapse for the Democrats. And it shows how misguided they were in trying to play this elite celebrity politics game instead of using the economic issues and the class politics that could have actually won over swing voters as Donald Trump was handing over a $1 trillion tax cut to the rich. It's just so depressing to watch.
That's the voice of Max Blumenthal. Max joined us from Washington, D.C. He is a best-selling author and journalist. His latest film is Killing Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project, and he is the co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
British Prime Minister Theresa May was dealt yet another blow yesterday as Parliament seized control of the decision-making process as Brexit goes down to the wire. Will her government fall? Will the much-dreaded no-deal hard Brexit scenario come to pass? We're joined in studio by Eugene Puryear. He's the host of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary, which you can listen to Monday through Friday from 2 to 4 p.m. Welcome back, Eugene.
Thanks so much for having me.
Eugene, I was taken aback yesterday when I saw news that that Parliament has essentially seized decision-making authority from their own prime minister, and they're just taking over this process. What exactly are we looking at here?
Well, I think what we're looking at here is just an indication of how much Theresa May's leadership has essentially totally failed and that she is really now at the end game for her. Now, of course, her deal that she negotiated with the EU could still potentially be alive. They're going to vote again on Thursday and we can talk more about that. But at the end of the day, I think seeing Parliament can take control of the reins here is a sign of two things. One, that there is a loss of confidence in May's ability to really steer the discussion and steer the debate in a way that can gain confidence. And two, I think that it may be an indication of the fact that Parliament itself may be preparing for a snap general election, and this is maybe the first step, the sort of sidelining to a degree of Theresa May to recognizing that most of these votes probably will not succeed. Tomorrow, they're going to vote on a bunch of alternative options. Thursday, it looks like they're going to vote again on May's deal. It doesn't look like any of those things will be able to gain any sort of governing majority, and thus, I think that this sort of pre-sidelining of May, whether it's planned or somewhat subconscious, I think may reflect a change in the political situation there.
And there have been several different scenarios thrown out there as to what happens with these different votes. I mean, they've failed. They've all failed so far. But the question at the end of all this is there any way that Theresa May can survive as prime minister, or is she done? She's already offered to resign in exchange for a thumbs up vote on her plan. That's still going to fail. Is this the end for her?
I think this is 100% the end for her. I think that even if her deal was to pass and people were to agree to it and those were the terms of Brexit, I think once the issue was settled, immediately the knives would be out inside the Tory party. And quite frankly, they have been for quite some time. I mean, Theresa May, to some degree, was kind of an unexpected prime minister in the way she was able to skillfully balance between the different elements. But I think it's pretty clear at this stage in the game. And even when you start to see people like Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's one of the main Eurosceptic people, say that he might be more willing to back May's deal, I think it's a sign that regardless of what happens, that she will almost certainly be gone. I think in a weird way, even if she succeeded with her deal, it might actually bring forward more quickly people trying to destroy her within her own party. So I think it's going to be tough for her to hang on much longer than the next couple months.
So within the Tory party in the UK, there are at least four different ideas for how to affect Brexit. None of them are popular. None of them have enough votes for passage. That makes me believe that we are approaching a hard Brexit with no deal either on a customs union or on the Irish border. Is there any way for the Tories to save this at the very end to make this easier on the British economy? Or is this just a disaster waiting to be finally implemented?
I think that it's going to be difficult because I think part of the problem is that a lot of the Tories are really playing a double game. I think regardless of what they say, many of the Tories actually do want a hard Brexit. I think certain the Rees-Moggs of the world want a hard Brexit. I think there are many others who were essentially backing that. To some degree, this is why David Cameron wanted to hold the initial referendum, was to try to sideline these individuals who are becoming a louder voice inside the party. And so I think there are a lot of people who aren't willing to. Now, would it be possible? Yes. I mean, first and foremost, they could just cancel Brexit. I mean, that certainly is potentially still out there.
And there are more than 5 million signatures on a petition to do exactly that.
And almost certainly in a cross-party reality, they might be able to make something like that happen. I mean, I think the European Union, which is saying that it is totally unwilling to revisit anything, I think would in fact be willing to revisit it if the terms were being given to them were of a greater capitulation. In other words, if things that the Europeans had wanted that May would not budge on were on the table, which certainly potentially could happen. But again, I think the challenge is that I don't actually think there's a majority in the Conservative Party to make enough of who, or let me put it to you like this, when given the option of taking a step back to some degree, or in fact going with hard Brexit, would not go with hard Brexit. But that being said, if there was a snap general election to try to resolve some of these issues, I suspect that if the Labour Party was able to succeed in winning, or perhaps the Conservatives were able to put someone forward with a more sort of soft Brexit position, I think the European Commission might try to take a different position. The Norway-style deal, the Canada-style deal, other things that a lot of Labour members have put forward are certainly much more beneficial to the European Union. Many people consider those deals to be very unfavorable to those countries and much more favorable. You get pretty much not as much back as you have to put into the European Union in terms of funds, freedom of movement, and the like. So ultimately, I think that possibility is still in the wings. I think part of the reason the European Commission was willing to extend the deadline and really sort of set up a fait accompli that may, I think, lead to an election is I think they are hoping, this is my view, I don't know this to be sure, I think they don't want this to happen, they don't want Brexit to happen, and they know the best way is for there to be an election fought on the issue of whether there should be no Brexit or a soft Brexit, and a new government coming in on either of those two positions, renegotiating the deal with them. I think they're hoping they can save it, but unclear.
I'm curious, too, as to where the Liberal Democrats are in this. You know, the Liberals had been kept out of government for, what, three generations. They finally entered into a coalition government with the Conservatives, only to see their popularity plummet to the point where they may not even survive as a party once this is done. They've been shockingly silent through this whole thing, and indeed haven't even really been involved in the negotiations. So what's up with the Liberals?
I mean, I think the Lib Dems are certainly looking at the precipice. I mean, I think the decision by Mr. Cable to go into the government with Cameron was highly problematic because then it signed them up for a number of austerity measures, particularly around school fees and the like, that many of the people in their base did not agree with. Sort of the basis of the Lib Dems, of course, is, yes, they're not as far to the left as Labor, but they certainly are not, you know, or at least their voters, are not really voting with them because they want a Tory policy on economic issues, on social issues, but really more around issues of the environment, around issues of, you know, in some cases, fiscal responsibility or whatever it may be. They're really a centrist party, and they abandon that centrist positioning by attaching themselves to David Cameron's agenda, and people essentially jump ship on them. Some of them ultimately went back to Labor. Some of them, I'm sure, may back this new independent group. And I think really the best chance for the Lib Dems is similar to how the SDP and the Liberals came together to create the Liberal Democrats,
right,
if they can bring in these independent group MPs, but they themselves aren't that popular in their own constituencies because Corbyn's popularity in Labor has pushed them to the side. So I think the Lib Dems are in a similar position, quite frankly, to the Green Party, which has been facing a lot of pressure because their politics were dependent on Labor moving to the right, now that Labor's moved to the left. So I think some of the smaller third parties that aren't based on, say, Scottish nationalism or whatever it may be, are going to have some difficulty here in an election that I think would really take things back to a two-party first-past-the-post kind of situation. Real strong polarization between the two major parties.
Eugene, I'm looking at The Guardian today. Just 7% of UK public think government has handled Brexit well. That's according to a study. But what would it mean to handle it well? There's been several votes. There's a majority for no, saying no to Theresa May's deal, which is basically a temporary soft Brexit with the future by 2020 uncertain. But what would there be a majority for, given the way the Tories are split and the position of the Labour Party and the fact that the two parties are fighting for power? I mean, what is Theresa May to do?
I think she's in between a rock and a hard place. And I think a lot of that is because the issue of Brexit was to some degree not really fought on the issue of the facts on the ground, as it were. I mean, for instance, the Brexit campaign with the battle bus, as they call them in the UK, those big red two-tier buses that go around and are, you know, done for the elections, they call them battle buses, that they were sitting around for Brexit was saying that they were going to get $300 million a week or something outrageous like that, £300 million that they would then pump into NHS. But the people who were promoting this are all people who in their time in government wanted to gut the NHS.
And that's the National Health
Service. And so people were thinking, okay, if we remove ourselves from Brexit, we will be able to roll back some of the austerity measures that have been put in place, when in fact, most of those decisions have had nothing to do with the EU. They've had to do with the austerity government starting with Ms. Thatcher and going through Mr. Blair. So ultimately, I think that people thought something was going to happen that wasn't going to happen. And then you get to the stage of trying to manage Brexit. But so many of the issues around the historical positioning of the United Kingdom, the nationalist sentiments in some elements of the United Kingdom, and so on and so forth, are also very deeply rooted in this. And I think that that is one of the challenges in managing this.
Okay, we'll leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by Eugene Puryear. He's the host of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary, and you can listen to that Monday through Friday from 2 to 4 p.m. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Most of Venezuela suffered another blackout yesterday, although power was restored in much of the country within several hours. The government said that this was the result of another series of attacks on the country's electrical system and also presented evidence tying top opposition leaders to a plot to carry out terrorist attacks throughout the country. We're joined from Caracas, Venezuela by Ricardo Vaz. He's a writer and editor at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. His articles also have appeared at Mint Press News, Truthout, Counterpunch, and other alternative media. Welcome, Ricardo.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Ricardo, you have published a piece at VenezuelaAnalysis.com entitled "Venezuelan Government Presents Evidence of Alleged Opposition Paramilitary Plot." Those are strong words, but you also include a photograph. And listen, I'm a career counterterrorism professional. This photo looks like a terrorist attack to me. Tell us what we're looking at here.
Yes, so this was a press conference given by the communications minister, Jorge Rodriguez, on Friday. So this started on Thursday with the arrest of Guaido's chief of staff. And, you know, at the time they said he was involved in leading terrorist activities. And then there was this press conference on Saturday where, you know, using evidence that they gathered from his phone, apparently, and, you know, this needs to be taken with a grain of salt, I mean, we need more evidence, there were plans to bring in paramilitary mercenaries, you know, hired from Colombia and Central America to carry out targeted killings and acts of sabotage. And, you know, there were lots of details in these discussions uncovered in the phone of Guaido's chief of staff. And there were other arrests made during the weekend. A paramilitary leader was arrested here in central Venezuela. And someone who was supposed to be a financial operator was also arrested on Sunday. And then yesterday, as you were saying in the introduction, we had two outages. The first one was short-lived. You know, within a couple of hours or within 3 hours, we had power back in Caracas. And, you know, a couple hours more, it was more or less restored throughout the country. And then at night, at, let's say, 9:45, we had another outage that lasted until about an hour ago.
You know, John, the Venezuelan government has compared what happened to it, or at least observers in Venezuela, to what the CIA did, and we know they did it now, along with Israeli intelligence, to the Iranian nuclear program.
Yes.
With the Stuxnet virus. It sabotaged and
That's
destroyed
right.
their nuclear machines, right? And then they couldn't, the CIA and Israel couldn't control it.
It took on a life of its own and it escaped.
Yeah, and at the same time that Stuxnet was happening, between 2010 and 2012, a whole number of Iranian nuclear physicists became the victims of assassination, all at the same time.
Imagine.
Just imagine. I mean, if anyone says, well, how can Venezuela prove this? Well, of course, they're trying to prove it. And our guest is helping provide the information that the Venezuelan government is providing to prove their case. But as we said to Daniel, or as Daniel Ellsberg said to us last week, and he was a high Defense Department official. He released the Pentagon Papers. He said, when you look at what happens and what's been happening in Venezuela, even without exact proof, the circumstantial evidence regarding the pattern of behavior completely comports to what the CIA and what the United States covert operations have done elsewhere over and over and over again.
Absolutely. The first attack we had yesterday, according to Venezuelan authorities, was also a cyber attack, you know, similar to the one that caused the first major outage about 3 weeks ago. And as you said, you know, there's only circumstantial evidence. I mean, it's not clear whether they'll ever be able to prove beyond any doubt that this was a cyber attack directly from the U.S. But what I would say is that, you know, the other alternative explanations that were put forward, they become less plausible with time. So, for example, the opposition was circulating the idea that instead of a cyber attack, this was kind of a major lack of maintenance and the system was, you know, in really poor condition. But if that were the case, then the system would not have been brought back online so successfully and so quickly. So this gives the idea that, you know, regardless of the fact that lack of maintenance and the poor state of infrastructure is a fact, this was a cyber attack directed at the, you know, at the heart of the system. However, last night, the second attack, which was in the evening, set fire to several transformers in the Guri Dam. So these are kind of where the electricity is generated before being sent by these high voltage cables to the rest of the country. So this was a physical fire which has also been attributed to the opposition. So this, of course, raises other questions, you know, because 2 weeks ago, the Venezuelan military held drills precisely with the goal of protecting electrical infrastructure. So how was it possible that, you know, someone set fire to the transformers? Was it done remotely? This is something that we still need to understand, and we are, you know, kind of slowly getting back online. But just to conclude, the idea that the United States or the opposition would attack the electric grid is not a subject of speculation. You know, we're not imagining it. And the best proof, in my opinion, is that when the opposition was in control of the National Assembly, you know, before it went in contempt of court and was pretty much marginalized itself, they tried to pass an amnesty law where they wanted to provide amnesty for a series of crimes that they alleged were committed for political reasons. And one of these kinds was precisely attacks against the electrical grid. So it's very much a confession that this is a political tactic.
That's really important, that when they were in charge of the National Assembly, the opposition introduced bills that amnestied individuals who carried out attacks, including violent attacks, including on the electrical grid, if those attacks were motivated for political reasons.
This amnesty bill, I mean, in the end, it was struck down by the Supreme Court because it was unconstitutional. But it basically allowed, you know, everyone from, you know, terrorism to drug offenses to just claim that they had done it for political motives and then be granted amnesty.
What about the idea that John Bolton, a national security advisor to Trump, could tell the Maduro government and the Venezuelan government that if they elect this individual, Juan Guaido's advisor, for terrorism, or for an investigation on terrorism, it would be, quote, a big mistake. I mean, is the United States says it's involved in a worldwide global struggle against terrorism. Or is it that if individuals who engage in terrorist activities are politically favorable to or politically favored by Washington, then terrorism may be cool. And if you arrest them, you're going to be the target of the United States. I mean, that's what the short explanation of John Bolton's comments.
Yes, I mean the word terrorism has been so distorted that it basically means someone acting against the interests of the United States. You know, if terror is advancing U.S. interests, then, you know, you may be called a rebel or even someone fighting for democracy and freedom or what have you. So yeah, I mean, here clearly the security services forgot to ask for permission from U.S. authorities to arrest someone they suspected to be involved in terrorist activities. And this, if this is confirmed, it's actually pretty serious that they were transferring money to hire foreign paramilitaries, and, you know, according to official information, this is yet to be confirmed. Some of these paramilitaries have made their way into Venezuela and are now being sought. So this is something serious that, you know, I'll stress, still needs to be proven more conclusively. But again, it does not differ from, you know, the pattern of activity, especially from this very fringe right-wing section of the opposition, which is now kind of taking the lead ever since Juan Guaido became kind of the figurehead of the opposition.
Yeah, and John, we're here in Washington, D.C. If political opponents of the U.S. government, be they domestic or foreign, attack the electric power grid and all of us lost electricity, we couldn't travel on the metro, we couldn't have heat or air conditioning, I think people in Washington would consider that a terrorist action.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because such a thing actually happened in Northern California about 8 years ago. And it was never solved. High-powered rifles were used to shoot an electrical substation, and it was classified as a terrorist attack by the U.S. government. I wish we could talk about that more, but we're going to have to leave it there. We were very pleased to be joined from Caracas, Venezuela, by Ricardo Vaz. He's a writer and editor at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. His articles have appeared at Mint Press News, Truthout, Counterpunch, and other alternative media. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Ecuador on Sunday held elections for local offices and governorships, but the Moreno government was extremely slow to announce results, leading to speculation that the election was not necessarily free and fair. Meanwhile, aides to WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange note that security at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Assange has sought asylum, has increased significantly, and a U.S. Department of Justice jet used recently to render a Russian hacker landed last week in London, only to then return to the U.S. empty yesterday. We're joined from London by independent journalist Denis Rogatyuk. Denis, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Denis, let's talk about Ecuadorian elections first, then I'd like to move into Julian Assange's situation. I'm having trouble, as a relatively well-informed observer of these issues, I'm having trouble understanding exactly what's happening in Ecuadorian politics. Everybody thought that President Moreno would be a force for progress, a force from the left. That just simply hasn't panned out. What are we seeing in Ecuador right now?
I can assure you that you're certainly not the only one. Really, what we've seen in these in the elections that took place on Sunday is a real, I would say, an exposure of what Lenin Moreno really turned out to be. He really turned out to be a party figure, not only without an ideology, but also without any real backbone, so to speak. Since his election in 2017, he has effectively been dismantling a lot of the economic and political reforms and achievements of President Rafael Correa in favor of the right-wing neoliberal opposition of that country. I think the most visible sign of that has actually been Moreno's request for $4.2 billion of funding from the International Monetary Fund, which we know from the experience of Latin America of the 1980s and 90s, that what kind of reforms and what kind of effects that has on the economy. So, including the destruction of labor law protections, privatizations, mass reductions of social and public spending. And we clearly started to see more signs of that in the lead up to the elections on Sunday. We saw cutbacks of 10,000 public service employees. We saw reduction in social spending. We saw reductions in fuel and gas subsidies. So really a beginning, I believe, of a harsh neoliberal austerity plan under this government.
Let's talk about what actually happened with the elections this weekend.
Well, the elections on this weekend, there were two main series of elections that took place. One were the elections on the local and municipal and regional level, and the others were the election for the Council for Citizens' Participation and Social Control, or the CPCCS. Now, the Council for Citizens' Participation is effectively an elected legal body that oversees the Supreme Court and has the power to appoint legal officials to offices such as Attorney General, the Comptroller General, and members of the National Electoral Council. So, in some ways, I would say it is just as important as the elections, as the local elections. With regards to the results that we've received so far in the local elections, the Alianza País, so the party that was originally started by Rafael Correa, but then was effectively seized and used as a political machine tool by Lenin Moreno, has effectively crashed. I mean, they lost every single governorship that they held. They've also lost the majority of the mayoral local elections throughout the country. At the same time, we saw the rise of a new political force called List Number 5, which was headed by the allies of Rafael Correa in Ecuador. And they succeeded, despite having an extremely limited level of resources, having almost no access to the media. They managed to win the governorships of Pichincha and Manabí. And Pichincha is the second most populous state in Ecuador and is a, sort of a key bastion of support for former President Correa. We're also getting reports that they've won mayoralships and councils in the, throughout the rural areas. Another significant development of the election has also been the rise of the right-wing Social Christian Party, which has been mainly dominated by the figure of Jaime Nebot, so the long-standing mayor of Guayaquil. That's mostly the summary of the results in the local and regional departments. Now, with regards to the results for the CPCCS, now this is where the most controversy has been. These ones have been the most controversial. As in the lead up to the election on Sunday, there have been numerous reports coming from the Electoral Council that there would be like special rules applied to the counting of votes. For instance, several days before the election, the council announced that every single invalid vote would be counted as three null votes. There were also attempts to disqualify certain candidates from standing, especially the candidates who were supported by former President Correa. In the end, the process appeared to have gone normally. That was, of course, up until the counting, the vote counting began. In the early hours of March 25th, the website of the Electoral Council crashed and was inactive for about 30 minutes or so. And when it came back up, the results for the Council of Citizens Participation effectively changed. So we saw the change in the number of votes for the candidates were supported by Correa, and then redistribution of those votes among other candidates. So this has been the biggest controversy of the elections so far.
Well, Dennis, if I could interrupt you, because we're so short on time, we have about 2 minutes left. I want to ask you about Julian Assange. Julian's circle is reporting back discreetly, privately. They haven't gone public with this necessarily, that the mood has changed inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The attitude of the Ecuadorians has changed since President Moreno became president, and that the Ecuadorians want Julian out. They want him. They haven't expelled him, of course, but they want him to leave, whether it's voluntarily or otherwise. And indeed, there's evidence that this Department of Justice rendition plane landed in London, sat on the tarmac for a day and a half or 2 days, and then returned to the United States empty. What's happening with Julian vis-a-vis the Ecuadorians in London? And do you see something bad happening in the near future?
I mean, President Moreno actually came out publicly in December last year and said publicly that they are trying to actively encourage Julian Assange to leave the embassy. So this process of trying to remove Julian from the embassy really has been in the works in the last 1.5 years. But I believe that the events of the last few weeks in London really tied to Moreno's deal with the IMF for the acquisition of $4.2 billion, and of course tied to these latest elections. I believe that if the elections don't turn out to be in favor of Moreno and he is removed from his current position as president through the means of a referendum for revoking his presidency, I believe that he could be trying to effectively to send off and sell off Julian Assange to the United States would be his best bet to try to remain in power with the support of the right-wing political parties in the country. Having said that, Moreno is also facing a very significant charge of corruption with regards to the inner investment corporation bank, which he and his family used as a tax haven in Panama, and through which they received bribes and commissions during his time as vice president, and also during his time in Geneva. So, trying to these events in London, I believe, are a demonstration that Moreno is becoming increasingly nervous about his own position and trying to distract the public from his own failures.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from London by independent journalist Dennis Rogatiuk. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.